You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis in for Cynthia Canty. You know, a few months ago, Senator Kamala Harris, who is running for president, participated in a CNN town hall, and one young man stood up and asked this question.
In a society where nearly one in five children live in poverty, yeah. Is the existence of multi-billionaires morally defensible?
Well, let's just say this. We have had policies in this country, at least in the last two decades, that have disproportionately benefited the top 1% to the exclusion of working families.
Harris equivocated a bit in her answer, but the role of the ultra-wealthy in our society is likely to come up more and more often in the next year. Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, they all have plans to change taxes for the wealthy. And as we've seen in recent years, billionaires bankroll major political campaigns. But billionaires also invest in the tangible world around us. They build hospitals and schools. They put their names on infrastructure and major developments. And they make decisions with their dollars that impact all of us. Over the next few weeks, we'll look at the influence of billionaires in a few of our own cities. Later in the program, we'll start with Detroit. But first, here to help us understand the role of billionaires in American society is Darryl West. He's vice president and director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and he authored a book titled Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust. Darryl, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
I really wanted to talk to you about this idea of wealthification of politics and society. Is there a clear trend that's happening where the uber wealthy are having a larger impact than they used to?
Wealthy people are having a tremendous impact on American society, the economy, politics, and philanthropy. I mean, it's an era of great income inequality, so there are people who have an extraordinary amount of money. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars up through the billions of dollars. And these people are at the pinnacle of society. People pay attention to what they say. I mean, they are in a major leadership role in the United States.
But is that growing? I mean, I think when you say that we are in this period of income inequality, I think we talk about that and feel that a lot as we look at our cities and rural areas around us. But we also, I think it's easy for us to travel back and look at images and stories from the Great Depression, you know, juxtaposed against billionaires throwing cash into the fireplace, you know, to keep their rooms warm. Is this really a period of income inequality that looks different from what we had before?
I mean, you're certainly right if one goes back 100 years that there was high income inequality at that point. But after World War II, income inequality declined substantially and actually reached a low point in 1976. There were a variety of public policies, tax policies, infrastructure investments, investments in education and healthcare that created a more egalitarian society. But since 1976, we have reverted to the historic pattern. Income inequality today is as high as it was 100 years ago. Hmm. So the pattern over the last 40 to 50 years has been rising income inequality and more wealth in fewer and fewer hands.
Does that mean that we're in some sort of pendulum swing where we're going to see ourselves back into a fiefdom of sorts, or this sort of stratification where we're just talking about aristocracy and you know, people out plowing the fields?
Well, we could be in an era where we maintain high income inequality and basically kind of deal with the status quo that we have and people allow that to continue. But historically, that often has not been the case. There obviously is a lot of concern about income inequality. I mean, one of the reasons why we have slow economic growth is the middle class doesn't have money. You know, the tax cuts have gone disproportionately to the wealthy, and so it's just harder for the average person to pay for education, pay for health care, buy the first home, and do all the things that you need for a vital economy.
You know, in your book that there are several hundred billionaires in America, and that seems like a lot, but it's actually quite a small group of people, obviously, compared to our population. So who are their friends and peers? You know, if there's only a few of them in each state, who do they hang out with?
Actually, wealthy people like to hang out with other wealthy people or people who are prominent in politics, society, or a culture in general. I mean, there are a lot of private clubs, so there are places for these people together. Elite universities are a major gathering ground. Some of these people graduated from, you know, the Harvards and Stanfords and Princetons of the world, and they go back and, you know, regularly engage with those places. So the thing that has happened in the United States is what we call sorting, in which people have sorted themselves out by income level, by education, and a variety of other things. And so there's more segregation across a variety of different dimensions, and a lot of that is linked to income.
It's a self-segregating along, because when I think of self-segregating, I think of groups along ethnicity and racial lines, but you're talking about income brackets as well.
Absolutely. And our society is layered in the sense that, you know, at each level of income, there are different kinds of opportunities. Like, you know, when you're flying on an airplane, there's coach and business class. Mm-hmm. But the really wealthy people have private jets or they have access to corporate jets. So, you know, they're not flying commercial. They have their own airline system, their private schools where the children of the wealthy attend. And so, you know, this self-sorting has intensified as the income inequality has spread. Wealthy people are a little insulated from average people today.
So after they have self-segregated, how do they spend their leisure time? What do most of the uber wealthy in our society do to cut loose?
I mean, I know a number of wealthy people who live in New York City, and the funny thing is there is a certain pattern to their lives in the sense that they're in New York in the spring and fall. In the summer, they go to the Hamptons, and they have parties and socialize with the very people that they know from Manhattan. And then, of course, in the wintertime, a lot of these people go to Palm Beach in Florida. And so they're a little bit like migratory birds that, based on the season, they congregate in different places, but they're still hanging out with each other.
We're speaking with Darrell West. He's Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at Brookings. He also authored a book titled Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust, published in 2014. Darrell, you write about billionaires using their money to influence politics and the communities they live in or the society around them. So what are the benefits and pitfalls of someone like a Betsy DeVos influencing education policy or a Dan Gilbert in Detroit building up in a relatively poor city like Detroit?
We see a lot of billionaires who want to influence society and want to influence public policy. So they often have a pet cause that they're really focused on. So in the case of Betsy DeVos, her issue is education. And she's been a big charter school advocate and basically freeing public schools of regulatory constraints so they can become more innovative. So through the foundation, the DeVoses have funded a lot of education causes along the lines of what they want. Dan Gilbert has done the same thing in Detroit. He's been a big investor there, tried to help revitalize the city. So the ultra-wealthy often use their money for good causes, but they often have a particular take on that cause. So it's not just investing the money and saying, you know, to that organization, you know, you're interested in education, you can figure out how best to advance it. They have an agenda. They often have a solution that they want these organizations to implement.
It seems to me that that's kind of foisting upon a large population the ideas of the few. Is that sort of the problem that we're bumping up against here?
It is the problem in the sense that, you know, you have the Bill Gates of the world who's done tremendous philanthropy and he's invested a lot in vaccines in the developing world. And I think, you know, everybody would recognize that is a good contribution. There are other people who basically are investing to try and bring about change of a type that they prefer. And so people worry that philanthropy has changed in a particular way that, you know, in the good old days when I was growing up, you know, the wealthy would give a university or give a nonprofit organization money and say, you know, you figure out the best solution. Now the wealthy are very interested in having an impact, there often is a solution that they favor. And so there's more pressure for those nonprofit organizations to act in accordance with the interests of the wealthy.
Well, what happens to a community when it begins to rely on philanthropic money that comes from the uber wealthy? What does it do to a system of government at the community level?
I mean, local communities often are very dependent on philanthropy because, you know, tax revenues have been cut back and taxes have been cut in a number of different communities. And so a lot of municipalities are starved for resources. They face tremendous problems in terms of economic development, income disparities, racial issues, and so on, but they don't have the resources to really address it. And so they often have turned to philanthropists. Newark is an example of this. When Cory Booker was mayor there, Mark Zuckerberg gave the city a huge amount of money for the public schools because he was interested in doing a better job and kind of helping those schools become more innovative. So that's an example of what ultra-wealthy people are trying to do.
Are we seeing any cases where communities are beginning to, or municipalities really, are beginning to rely on philanthropic money more than taxpayer dollars that are coming in the door?
I don't think they're relying more on philanthropy compared to tax dollars, but the amount of philanthropy has increased over time. So they are certainly becoming more dependent on those kinds of dollars and therefore more subject to the whims of the wealthy, you know, whether that whim happens to be good or bad, broad-minded or narrow-minded. Local communities are much more dependent on the wealthy for needed services.
How did you become interested in the influence of billionaires?
About 5 or 6 years ago, I was thinking one day just about billionaires who I had encountered, and I realized I did a little mental list, and it had added up to I'd had dealings with about 19 billionaires, which seemed to be a large number.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking that, you know, I could see in an era of income inequality, billionaires were playing a greater role. And of course, today America has a billionaire president. So that's the epitome of this. And so I just wanted to write a book that looked at their role historically, what they're doing in terms of the contemporary period, what has been their impact on the political process, how are they using their money?
Well, what was the most surprising thing to you as you were doing your research for this book?
I mean, the most surprising thing is just how our society has become oriented to wealth really at every level. I mean, wealth is affecting every segment of the economy, every part of society. So I had this term wealthification just to describe how wealth is permeating everything. And, you know, we need to kind of step back and think about that and take a close look at it because the wealthy often have political views or social views that are different from the rest of society. But because of their money, they have much greater impact, but they're not really representing the views of everybody else. They're representing their own views, and their views often are more conservative than exists in the society as a whole.
So these are ostensibly also the job creators that we so desperately need to keep us out of recession. Is that true that when we hear that these are job creators? Are billionaires creating a large share of the jobs that the average worker is in need of?
They certainly have created jobs. There's no question about that. And many of them have been very innovative in terms of their business practices and have altered entire segments of the economy. But if you look at the overall numbers, two-thirds of the jobs in America are created by small and medium-sized businesses. So it's not the large companies that you know, were founded by billionaires, and they might have started out small or medium-sized companies, but now are mega companies. The engine of job growth in America still is small businesses.
So when we say small business, Daryl, do we mean somebody who owns that business is making employees, what, like a dozen people or less? What are the metrics that we sort of base a small business around?
I would say a company that employs less than 100 people, as opposed to, you know, like the Facebooks of the world, which have 25,000 employees,
right,
or Microsoft has 125,000 employees. So we're really talking about those that have fairly modest workforces, but there are a lot of these types of companies. You know, they might start out as a mom and pop shop, and you know, they hire a few people, the company becomes more successful, and they expand. But those are the companies that are really creating a lot of the jobs these days.
Should we question in our capitalist society the ethics of the existence of billionaires, especially in a country where we still see high rates of poverty, housing insecurity, hunger? I mean, sort of these troubling issues that linger on. And as you said, we're in this era where the disparity is growing, or at least not improving. Is it ethical to even be a billionaire?
I mean, the important thing during a time of great income inequality is to preserve the American dream and economic opportunity for hardworking people. So I grew up on a dairy farm in southern Ohio, you know, family of modest means, but I got a good education, got a PhD, taught at Brown, I work at Brookings now. So I've had tremendous opportunities in my life. I worry that the generations that have come after me, for a variety of different reasons, don't have the same opportunities that I have. So there's nothing wrong with wealth per se, but we have to keep our eye on preserving economic opportunity for everyone. Like, we don't want to become an aristocracy where you have to be rich in order to have economic opportunity, go to the great schools, and be able to carve out a great job for yourself.
We saw a town hall not so long ago where I believe Kamala Harris was asked that same question about whether or not it was ethical to have billionaires or whether we should have billionaires. And barring her answer, which I can't remember off the top of my head, it occurred to me that that might be a question we end up facing more and more. Do you expect that we'll hear that question more in a political arena as well?
The issue of great wealth certainly is on the agenda for the 2020 campaign because of tax policies and the need to repair the social safety net. So people are going to be putting all sorts of ideas on the table. Elizabeth Warren, for example, has proposed a wealth tax, which is, you know, in contrast to an income tax, it would be a tax on the assets of people as opposed to just the income that they make. There's a call for a more equitable tax policy so that if there are tax cuts, they don't go mainly to the wealthy, but they go to the middle class as well. There's a need to invest in education. We know colleges and universities have become very expensive, so it's hard for people of modest means to be able to afford to go to them. So there are a lot of proposals on the table, free community college and free college in general, Medicare for all, that is seeking to address some of these aspects of income inequality.
My last question is about the legacy or the lasting impact of billionaires in general. What do they aspire to leave behind for the most part?
I mean, billionaires are like everyone else in the sense they want to have a positive impact. Now, they've had a positive impact in the business world. They've been very successful. They've accumulated tremendous wealth. But the billionaires I know are not happy just with that achievement. That's quite an extraordinary achievement. They want to have a positive impact on the rest of society. So a lot of them are engaged in philanthropy, and that's certainly a good benefit. They want to bring the knowledge that they accumulated in the business world to improving education, improving healthcare, kind of doing a range of other things. Like, they don't want to just be known as someone who made a lot of money. They want to use their money for good purposes.
Darryl West, thank you so much for joining us today on Stateside.
Thank you.